Greetings, my name's Andrew Sumner. My grandfather, Pop Smythe, bought me my first comic book in Liverpool, England, when I was 3 years old, and I spent the next 50 years hurtling around the pop culture kaleidoscope, first as a fan, and then as a journalist, editor, publisher, and presenter. Along the way, I met a bunch of interesting people who will be joining me here, creators, performers, professionals, and public servants. We live in divisive, fractured times, but art and popular culture connect people from all viewpoints and from all walks of life. I'm often struck by the passions people enjoy, that they can set aside their differences for and agree on, whatever those passions are, whether I share them or not. And that spark, that moment of instinctive, connective agreement, that's what I call a hard agree.
Vaccination Centre was very well organised. It felt very casual, which is a good thing. Everybody's quite happy. They know what they're doing, you know. Yeah. And, of course, the immunity kicks in after sort of 3 weeks, and then there's another jab after that, as you know.
So I'm privileged to be joined by none other than Dave Gibbons. How are you, mate?
I'm very well, Andrew. How are you?
Yeah, very well. We were just talking off camera about the whole scenario with the pandemic, and I'm pleased to see that you are forging ahead through that, mate.
I am, and I have had my jab, as I'm a respected elder citizen, and I'm very relieved to have had it. And I urge all your listeners to get their jab as soon as they possibly can. It's a game changer.
Absolutely. I'm looking forward to getting mine sooner rather than later. Some of my family have had theirs already. My folks who are still with us have had theirs. And I'm very pleased that you've had yours. And I'm sure the world of the comics faithful are very pleased that you've had yours as well, mate.
I feel like I have superpowers now.
Look, carry on.
But caution is the watchword. But it's strange on quite a profound level. It's funny. It's like a lot of things that you can become anxious about. It's there, but you don't see it until it goes. And I actually felt generally relieved and thinking, well, that's a step in the right direction. We're now moving away from that, albeit slowly. I mean, I wouldn't want to overstate it, because in many ways I've been very lucky as far as the whole lockdown thing is concerned. You know, as I may have said the last time we spoke, and lots of my professional colleagues have said, the life of a comic book artist is a fairly locked down thing anyway. So to sit in a room on your own and work from home is something I've done for the last 50 years or more.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, we live in a reasonable part of the country, so we've had it fairly good here. But I've just got that feeling of optimism, and that if we all just keep steady for a bit longer, you know, it's going to be okay.
Yeah, I amen to that. I think it's just to keep on ploughing the course we're on, and you know, get the vaccine when you can. That's the absolute key.
Absolutely.
So, Dave, I saw something the other day that made me think of you, and it was a piece of your work that I'd never seen before, and it was from the British Weekly anthology comic, and I'm putting that description in front for anybody who's listening who's American, you know, because of course anthology comics is how we all came to comic books in the UK. British comics are weekly and had multiple stories in black and white, printed in mono. But I ran into a story of yours I didn't even know existed, and it was The Spy in the Sputnik from the Hotspur, which I didn't even know you'd done anything for in like the mid 70s.
Yeah, well, when I broke into comics, I mean, if we've already covered this before, because to be honest with you, Andrew, I do so many of these Zoom calls.
Of course.
That I think, oh, my God, am I telling that guy the anecdote that I told him the last time?
Yeah.
But just briefly, the way that I broke into comics was by hanging around Fleetway, who are the major publishers of comics next to DC Thompson in the sort of early 70s. And I got to know a few people there, and I got to know an art agent by the name of Barry Coker, who said that having seen my fanzine work and odd little filler stuff that I'd done, that he thought he could get me regular work. So I threw my lot in with him, and he was very well connected to DC Thompson up in Dundee.
Yeah.
And they published a lot of kind of science fiction adventure kind of stories, which he could see was meat and drink to me.
Yeah.
And so I worked on a number of really quite obscure titles for DC Thompson, a fan was kind enough to scan in and send me kind of PDF versions of nearly everything I'd done for them. And there was the spy in the Sputnik. There was the Wriggling Wrecker, which was about a virus that ate concrete. There was the Year of the Shark Men, which was about an invasion by shark men from under the sea. There was the Flying Tripe Hound, which was about spotter planes in World War II, Lysander high-wing monoplanes that were used as spy planes and to drop people in and out of occupied France. There was the Cat and the Mouse, which was another World War II thing. Spring-Heeled Jack, it was a kind of an updating of the old Victorian Spring-Heeled Jack character. But in this case, he was a Victorian policeman whose secret identity was the sort of Spring-Heeled Jack. And the great thing about working for Thompson's was they didn't pay very well, but what they would do is give you really good guidance and really good critiques. I used to take the pencil pages into my agent, who would then send them up to Dundee, and they'd come back with notes and scribbles and post-its on them saying how I could improve the storytelling. That was mainly what they were focused on. And I got such good, practical, unpretentious, you know, actual craftsman teaching from them that it was an invaluable experience. Along the way, I did ghost a series that Ron Smith, you know, who later went on to work for 2000 AD, that he drew, called Nick Jolly, the Flying Highwayman, about this reincarnated highwayman who had this robot horse that could fly through the air. I mean, they're just such mad stuff. And if you look at a lot of the stuff that DC Thompson did, it had that real, almost hallucinogenic, you know, impossible nature to it. And also, a lot of the stories were actually repurposed from text stories that had run decades earlier. Yeah. So a staff member would retype a prose story into a comic strip sequence. So they were never, in a way, great comics, but they were great stories, great pot-boiling stories. And it was really there that I learned how to consistently tell stories in pictures on a weekly basis.
Now, that's really very interesting, because you and I definitely haven't talked about that before, and you're absolutely right. The thing about all the DC Thompson Adventure books, compared to the Fleetway IPC ones, they're really quite pedestrian. Mm. But as you say, they have this very off-kilter imagination sort of running through them, like marbling. And also at a point before, as I recall, Fleetway and IPC had really got into embracing science fiction and the kind of storytelling that, you know, appeared in Battle and then became the storytelling template for 2000 AD, which you were very much a part of. Before that, DC Thompson were doing things like creating their own superheroes and whatnot. Because you had, was it King Cobra was one of those?
King Cobra, and that was also drawn by Ron Smith.
By Ron,
Yeah. There were lots of things that were sort of on the... that they weren't kind of American, but they had a kind of slightly British feel to them. You know, they did focus on things that you didn't get in Fleetway, which was much more traditional. That was all school stories and sportsmen and World War II. And you might get the odd science fiction thing. But, I mean, the strange thing is that having spent most of my life quite successfully drawing essentially science fiction, it was always held to be very unpopular, which was why when they came to launch 2000 AD, it was a real uphill struggle, because the kind of common wisdom was science fiction doesn't sell. But I think that, as 2000 AD proved, there was an appetite for it. And I think there was something about the DC Thompson approach that was... it wasn't attempting to be worthy or great literature. It was just yarns. It was just tall tales.
Yeah, you know, right.
That was the kind of thing. And they also had great people working for them. I mean, it was a non-union outfit. It was very much a patriarchy, you know, that if your face fitted and you were prepared to do the work, you had a job for life, but you did what they said at the rates they paid. But you look at the artists who they had working for them, people like Leo Baxendale and Dudley D. Watkins, who was one of the most amazing artists ever to work in comics, so versatile. You know, and when you think of his Desperate Dan, which was such a bizarre thing, he was a cowboy, and he had like a little six shooter.
Yeah.
But he lived in a town in the north of England with his arm baggy.
No,
it was just crazy. It was really crazy, and so this, I think there's something very endearing about the kind of, you know, potboiling and sort of really weird stuff. I suppose because it was low rent. Nobody really cared, which, of course, has always been one of the things about comics, you know, that, well, they're just comics, so you can do anything just as long as you fill the pages up, you know.
Yeah, no, it's so true, because I definitely remember when I was first exposed to DC Thompson comics, and a lot of them was when I was at primary school. And I guess when I was about, let's say when I was about 10 years old, that's when Warlord first appeared, right, their war book. And definitely at that time, having the choice age 10 between Warlord and between Battle. Now, Battle is, by any stretch of the imagination, actually a much better comic. But for the 10-year-old me, I remember clearly preferring the more homogenized adventure that was in Warlord. Battle was too edgy for me age 10. Me age 15, I loved it. But back then, those kind of very straightforward, very Northern English tales really appealed to me.
Well, it's very strange. I mean, this is perhaps a slight diversion, but I was reading something about Carlos Esquerra the late Carlos Esquerra, unfortunately, who I knew a bit, and who actually worked through the same agent, Barden Press Features, and he was a hugely successful, very, very popular comic book artist. And I think part of the key to his success was his artwork looked like a kid could draw it. Now, no kid could draw as well as Carlos. Carlos was a wonderfully talented, very capable artist, but there was an informality about his work. There was no barrier. There was no kind of, oh, look at this artwork. You know, this is beautiful. It was just, I'm not even looking at the artwork. And it used to remind me of the way in your maths rough book at school, you know, you draw like a Stuka or something, and you draw all the bullets coming out of it, like bang, 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 you know, like a dotted line of tracer shells. And that was kind of Carlos's approach. And I'd seen Carlos draw, and I visited his studio once, and he used to draw with the kind of tools that you would draw in the back of your maths rough book with, you know, like a big beaten up old fountain pen with a bit of dingy old ink in it, and, you know, scribbled out on the page. But of course, when it was shot for reproduction and printed, it looked absolutely great because he knew exactly what to do. And I think maybe the DC Thompson thing kind of fell into that camp as well. There was nothing off-putting about the surface of it. It was quite welcoming, and it was very informal. And also, although to my taste now, it was very overwritten, there was a lot to read in it. You know, each picture had a caption. Each picture had a couple of word balloons in quite tiny mechanical type. And so, you know, I think it was a great place to work, because it was the sort of real ground floor of comics. It was nothing pretentious, nothing aspiring to be art. It was good, simply told stories with imagination. And obviously, because of you only have to look at the sales they used to get, a huge crowd pleaser.
Yeah, for sure. What's, I think, interesting was I was super aware of this the first time I encountered your work. And now that you've laid, what I realized now that you laid through some of those stories that you did for DC Thompson is some of those are familiar to me. So I must have read them at an early enough stage that I hadn't really clicked it was you. Because, and what I mean by that is when 2000 AD started, and I bought it from the first issue, I was a paper boy back at that point in the Liverpool suburbs. And I remember it leaping off the counter when I got paid my wages and I took it back home. But from the very first moment that I read Harlem Heroes, which I think started in issue one, right?
Yeah.
What was obvious about your artwork is that you had what felt to me like a very American sensibility compared to, from the moment I saw your stuff, I thought, man, you know, for the first time, I remember thinking I could really see your artwork in a DC Comics book, for example, which is ultimately where it went. And was that within you? Was that something that had you had a lot of access to US comics in addition to the British ones?
I mean, growing up, I read lots of English comics and lots of American comics as well. And I suppose that's why my style was kind of adaptable. To English eyes, it looked kind of American. But yeah. I think to American eyes, it didn't look American, which, of course, was one of the... Well, just to step back and take a look at the whole thing, if you were drawing for DC Thompson, what they wanted very much was for you to draw in a kind of house style, a fairly unobtrusive style, a style that was all about storytelling, not about artistic flourishes. So in a way, you were encouraged to be vanilla. You were encouraged to be straightforward in the way you approach things and the way you laid work out. 2000 AD, the brief was that everything looked different and exciting, and there wasn't a house style, that everything had new, fresh, exciting artwork. But I got the gig doing Harlem Heroes because they got a lot of artists to try out, a lot of English artists, artists called Barry Mitchell, who was a wonderful football illustrator, great, great artist. Ron Turner, who was a science fiction artist, who was one of my favourite artists when I was a kid. And they got a lot of Spanish and Italian artists to try, and nobody could give the Harlem Heroes the look they wanted. So it took me, who'd been schooled in superhero comics, to draw them flying through the air like superheroes flew through the air, with very sleek costumes, with no wrinkly bits or no bunching up or no kind of too practical looking details. You know, they looked like a vision of a flying god or something like that. So that kind of worked to my advantage. And then when DC Comics came along, I think what they found, what they were after, was us British artists who drew, who understood American comics and could draw in a way that wouldn't be too shocking to the Americans, but still were a fresh flavor. You know, they had a particular flavor and a particular DNA that the indigenous American comic books didn't have. And I think also, just to continue on my thesis for a bit longer, we were looking at the US from outside. So the things that took our imagination and our attention were the things that were everyday objects and sights to Americans. I've said this before, you know, things like the fire hydrants in a New York street were objects of huge fascination to me, although they wouldn't even be noticed by the average New Yorker who walked down the street. Or the water towers on the downtown.
The water towers in Ditko,
Yeah, which I, as far as I knew, Ditko had made up, like he made the rest of it up. So we were able to look at America, we were able to look at America and American characters with a slight outsider's view. So in a way, this being sort of transatlantic or mid-Atlantic or able to go either way, I'm sure was one of the big positive factors, you know, in my career. But also what was a big positive factor, just to state it once again, was the wonderful grounded training I got from DC Thompson, who really were the school of basics, really, you know, we must see this character's face. We need to see the action here. We need to see this key, you know, these things that tell the story. And then if after that you want to give them a bit of artistic style, fine. But that wasn't the point of the exercise.
I think that's so fascinating to hear you say, because the interesting thing about DC Thompson comics, of course, is if anybody's listening to this and you're an American fan of Dave's, an American comics fan, while you might have some passing knowledge of the IPC and Fleetway comics because they include 2000 AD and because they include the war books that have so heavily influenced Garth Ennis, for example, I think there are very few American comics fans who will have ever been exposed to a DC Thompson book or even know what they are. You know, it's so interesting to hear you talk about that period of time.
Well, I mean, it's a very interesting thing, because not only did I sort of get my start or my first regular work from them, but Brian Bolland did quite a bit of work for them, not quite as much as me. Even Mick McMahon, who went on to draw Dread, he did at least one, maybe two of their science fiction pocket digest books called Starblazer. Quite a lot of us, and I think Grant Morrison used to write for those science fiction books as well. So they were where you started. If you were starting out and you weren't completely there, that was a way you could get there. Kind of like in the States, if you work for something, I don't know, like Charlton Comics.
Yeah,
you know,
right. Yeah. I think that's a great analogy. Yeah.
You know, and so it was just great, but it wouldn't have been possible without an agent, because obviously they were up in Scotland.
Yeah.
And my agent had a very good relationship with them and was able to get me regular work from day one. So, yeah, so that is a fairly little known, but a hugely formative part of my comics career. And I suppose it's true for many people. My career began with 2000 AD, yeah, or probably even DC Comics. But I mean, I worked for DC Thompson's for a good 3 years, you know? Yeah. So it was a considerable chunk of my early time.
No, it's very interesting to hear you talk about, Dave. And I think the Charlton analogy is a good one, because if I remember correctly, the deal with Charlton is it was essentially owned by a printing company. Its existence was down to keeping the presses rolling in between commercial jobs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, they were primarily printers, and yeah, comics were a good cheap way of keeping things going. But people like John Byrne had his first stuff, and he went on to be a massive star in American comics. Where is he now? But anyway, I have to say that because I know John a bit and I love to tease him. And Dana, of course, was on the editorial, yeah, up there, and Joe Staton as well, who went on to work, yeah, for DC.
And it was a big refuge for Ditko each time he was between doing jobs for the majors, right? So yeah, if he wasn't working for DC or Marvel, he always defaulted back to Charlton.
Yeah, and it's rather interesting because in that case, and again, the thing that happens with low-rent stuff is that sometimes they don't care what you do as long as you fill the pages up. And I guess that, yeah, was the deal with Charlton. So Ditko was able to rattle through this stuff, drawing just the kind of thing he wanted. And I think by that time, I mean, he went in and out of Charlton a few times, but even after he fell out with Stan Lee, he knew that he had somewhere where to go where his work could be published. And he created some great stuff for Charlton. He did Captain Atom, who
oh man, yeah,
loved the artwork, and of course we slightly rode on that for Dr. Manhattan in Watchmen, yeah, particularly the little nod of the hat where they try and put a costume on Dr. Manhattan, and he's actually got that kind of chainmail Ditko Captain Atom thing, and the little helmet as well. So yeah, I mean, yeah, it's strange. I used to think of Charlton Comics at the time as being a bit weak and not really worth bothering with. But the more I look at the stuff now, the more intrigued I am by it. And I suppose that is a parallel even there with the stuff I did for DC Thompson.
Yeah, for sure. They are very interesting, Charlton Comics, I think. In some respects, they've got a kind of sort of dark energy to them. And because there's the distribution was so spotty, it was like some of my favourite single issues of comics come from the Charlton era. There was there's actually a brilliant run that they published on the Phantom.
Yes.
Where it started out and it was Jim Aparo, who's I've always loved.
Yeah.
And then it flipped to Don Newton. And the Don Newton era Phantoms have got these beautiful airbrush covers. But if you read the comics, they're actually very dark and they're kind of unlike any other Phantom stories I've ever read.
Yeah, that's true. I completely forgot about Jim Aparo. And, of course, he went on to be a mainstay of DC Comics. And Don Newton, who unfortunately passed away when he was quite young, his stuff had a real kind of muscular illustrative quality to it. So, yeah. In fact, you know, Andrew, when we finish our chat, I'm going to have to go over to my drawer and pull out some of these charts.
Yeah, right.
You're giving me back my taste for them.
No, it's wonderful. I think both what Newton and Aparo had in common, even though they've got very different styles, is they both had a kind of hyper masculinity to the characters that they drew. And if you look at their male, I mean, Jim Aparo's like male figures are really super male. Like his Bruce Wayne looks very, very masculine.
Very cracky.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm. Like somebody from a kind of 50s Aldo Ray movie or something, you know what I mean? He's not a guy his Batman doesn't exist in the 1960s or 70s. He's definitely a kind of, he's a Sam Fuller leading man type, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true. The other thing I used to like about Jim Aparo's work, and I can sort of identify with it, is he used to do his own lettering as well. And that, to me, always gave his work a real integrity. And it's always been a great advantage to me to do my own lettering as well. So Aparo, again, I mean, he has had a revival along the way, but he was one of these workhorse artists who just turned out great stuff day after day. And I remember reading an interview with him, and he would do a page a day. He would get up in the morning, pencil it out, letter it by lunchtime, ink it in the afternoon, on the pile, another page done, ready to go. So I admire that work ethic, which is like the work ethic I used to have before I became semi-retired. Yeah. But then I've earned it. Come on.
Right on. Exactly. You've got to enjoy your icon status, mate. I mean, you've got to get as much as you can out of it. I think with Jim, particularly in later life, right towards the end of his career, I guess the last decade or so, there was a period of time when he no longer inked himself and he didn't do his letters. But that very lengthy period, maybe 30 years of work, where he did his own inks and letters, all of his run on Brave and the Bold, for example, I think the great thing about him is he did all of those Brave and Bolds with Bob Haney, you know, 100 plus issues or whatever. And there's no hero he wouldn't make look good. Yeah, he never found anybody in the DC canon that he couldn't draw. You know, the same way that, you know, you get Kirby, he's a genius, but he couldn't draw Superman, right? He couldn't actually draw Spider-Man either. You know, Jim Aparo could literally draw anybody, and they were always in safe hands with him, I thought.
Yeah, he was very much. And I mean, I've always aspired to be the kind of artist who just rolls his sleeves up and gets on with it, you know. And I mean, Alan Moore famously said to me, and I have had it said by other people, that once they realised I could draw anything they asked me to, they felt they were in safe hands, you know. So I've always taken a great pride in adaptability, or perhaps having a style which is sufficiently informed by the general world of comics that you can ape, or you understand how different artists work. I would also have to say, I mean, he was an inspired writer at times, but Bob Haney was probably not the easiest writer to work with, because some of that stuff was really crazy.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I'm talking about DC Thompson, and their stuff was occasionally a bit kind of hallucinogenic, but Bob Haney's stuff was, you know. But I guess Jim Aparo just rolled his sleeves. Okay, this happens. I can do all that. Next page, you know.
Well, Haney was like famously dismissive of the nascent DC continuity, right? And so back in that era when all that stuff was first, fans were first making their imprint felt and continuity was becoming important, he always ignored that in his Brave and Bold stories.
Yeah.
And I think one of the stories you must be referencing on one level, do you ever read, I was talking to Garth Ennis about this the other day, do you ever remember reading that crazy Batman and Sergeant Rock team up that they did in Brave and the Bold?
I certainly read that, yeah.
Yeah, where Haney and Aparo actually appear in it. And what happens is the protagonists, the villains in the piece, like take Jim hostage. Yeah.
And he's going to his drawing board having to draw what they tell him to draw.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, draw a different outcome for the story.
Yeah, that I do remember that. I'll have to pull that out of the drawer as well, because that was but then I always used to love those stories where artists and writers appear. When Stan and Jack showed up in Fantastic Four number, was it 9, 11, something like that? This is brilliant. And then there was a little run of Sea Devils where there was Qbert and Rusty and Irv Novick, and they were all in the story. I used to absolutely love that kind of stuff, you know.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Me too. Me too. You're making me think for somebody else, actually, that often throughout his run did that quite a lot. Somebody I know you're a big fan of is it happened quite a lot with Eisner and his shop producing the Spirit, right? Particularly in the heyday, you know, kind of the 1945 to 1951 era.
Yeah.
And somebody I meant to ask you, but you're talking about lettering before. Mm. Are you familiar with Abe Kanigson, the guy who was the letterer on the Spirit?
Yeah, I am. Fantastic.
And he's just an amazing guy. You know, the thing with him is he kind of, did you read this at all? That they, you know, he disappeared, but he basically left the strip in about 51. Eisner never saw him again. Nobody ever heard from him ever again. And in recent years, one of those like Tomorrow's publications figured out what had happened to him. And he left art and design altogether. And he became a line dancing caller, you know, a country dancing caller. Some guy, that was his job, who calls out the plays when people do their various dances and whatnot.
Wow. You know. I mean, the thing that I'd heard about him, and it may even have been in one of those Tomorrow's magazines, which I used to absolutely love, was he never used to rule out guidelines for his lettering.
Amazing.
He used to do it straight on the board. And my very first lettering job for Fleetway, I did it one lunch hour when I was up there, and I was ruling out the lettering lines. And a guy called John Aldrich, who was a very experienced comic letterer, came up to me, looked over my shoulder and said, Dave, what are you doing? I said, I'm ruling out the guidelines. He said, are you measuring them all out? I went, yeah. He went, oh, you'd be all day doing that. Just do it freehand. So I freehand ruled out all these guidelines. And it was awful because all the letters ended up in different heights and everything. The editor of the comic blew a fuse. Des Skin, who was the assistant editor on it, was a comic called Core, C-O-R-2.
You can't make a monkey out of Gus, right?
Exactly. Well, this was some interior strip, and Des got a real bollocking about it, and I was told I'd never work in comics again. But I did get paid for it, and actually, I did come across a Xerox of the check that I got for it, my very first professional check for £2.50 for a page of lettering. So I really admire the skill it takes to letter without a safety net.
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing thing to do, for sure. I mean, something that you so you and I had quite a long conversation with Brian Bolland over the summer for the Forbidden Planet TV channel.
Yeah.
And within that interview, which I'll probably post the link to, we actually talked quite a lot in a linear sense about yours and Brian's career. And we covered off, you know, with some of your major high points, including Watchmen. So I'm not going to ask you in any detail about that today. I thought you'd appreciate that, mate. I'd just like to ask you the one question.
Yeah.
Is what you thought of the Lindelof show.
Oh, yeah, I thought that was great. I mean, I think, you know, when I first heard about it, when they first met up with me and told me about it, I thought, I'm not so sure about this. I don't know, but they were very respectful. I'm out with Damon Lindelof and a guy called Jeff Jensen, who's done all sorts of things. He's a journalist, was what he was doing when I first met him. And they were very reverential to me, and they kind of laid out in vague terms. And I was kind of, well, it sounds good. I appreciate you guys taking the time talking to me. I'd be interested in hearing more. And anyway, they started to send me screenplays, and I thought, this is just brilliant. I mean, even before I'd seen the whole thing working, I thought, now this is taking a really strange and unexpected angle on it. And I think what became apparent to me, there were several things I read where my feeling was, why didn't we think of that? That's so obvious. You know, it's like the best fiction is always so unexpected, but so obvious at the same time, you know?
Yes, yeah.
And then it was when I was over in Los Angeles, and I went to their studio where they were making, and I met up with the writers.
Yeah.
And I got shown, under conditions of strict secrecy, in a locked room with a guy watching me. I was shown the first episode. And even then, with, you know, not the final music track and with the special effects with placeholders, I thought, this is just amazing. It starts in a way that I never could have imagined. It's told me something about America that I didn't ever know. It's so far away from what Alan and I did, yet so faithfully linked to it that it feels really fresh and new. And as I think I said a couple of times, it felt not like a sequel, which I'm generally not in favor of, but it felt like an extrapolation. It was like, okay, I've dropped this stone in the lake over here. What's the pattern going to be like by the time it's bounced off the shore a few times?
Yeah.
And so I absolutely loved it. And I think my experience was very like, you know, fans and people who've seen it on the TV. They came into it not really expecting very much, expecting to be disappointed, but actually finding that it was one of the best TV things they'd seen. And I certainly felt that. There was one episode, I don't know if it's episode 5 or 6, and I got completely lost in it. You know how a good film or a good TV,
yeah,
you just forget everything. And I would have to say that it really is one of the best hours of television that I'd ever seen. I thought that the whole thing was fantastic. I also admired the way that it was 9 episodes, and that was enough to tell the story. And once Damon had told the story, he finished. And yeah, as far as I'm aware, he's resisted overtures to do a sequel. So again, that was like Watchmen. We did the 12 issues and it was done in that, and we never felt any desire to add anything to it. So, you know, it had the spirit of Watchmen as well. And I got to meet the cast, who were all brilliant and again were so nice to me and so respectful and was just such talented people. And nominated for 24 Emmys or something like that, all of which were very well deserved. So yeah, it was a great experience, much better than I ever would have imagined.
I mean, I think you're speaking for everybody who watched it, particularly everybody who's a comics fan, who had that sense of, oh dear, you know, can this be? And it's one of those beautiful experiences where they pull off everything against all the odds, against the weight of negative expectation. But for that's one thing, me watching it and thinking that and being blown away by it. But for you to genuinely have that experience and it's your baby, that must feel incredible.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sure by this time anybody who's wanted to see it has seen it. Yeah. So I don't think I'm going to particularly spoil it. But there were things like, well, first of all, making Hooded Justice black, that was so obvious. It was, of course, he wears a muck, and the noose.
And he has a noose on his neck,
Yeah, it's just so resonant. And what they did with Nostalgia as well, where we had it as a kind of a perfume, it was a kind of mind-altering drug in this. So it literally took you back to the days of yesteryear, you know. And that was an inspired thing to do. Yeah, I mean, it added everything they did added to Watchmen, rather than what can be risk with a sequel or a prequel is you actually dilute and subtract from it.
So I was
well, as you can tell, I'm an enthusiastic guy. Most times anyway, but I was completely and genuinely swept away by it.
I think that's great. I mean, speaking of enthusiasm, just like to, when we touched upon clearly some comic creators that you admire, but for you personally, who are your personal favourite writers and artists, or the ones who inspired you the most, or the ones whose work you simply enjoy the most?
Well, I mean, I'm tempted to say the usual suspects, because you obviously have to go in England, Hampson, Bellamy, you know, people like Brian Lewis, people like Ron Turner in the States, obviously Kirby, Ditko, Eisner, Kane, Infantino, you know, those people. But there are a couple of little favourite things. And again, I think I talked quite a bit about this before, and I'm sure I have talked about it elsewhere online, was I used to love a comic called Race for the Moon, which was drawn by Jack Kirby, inked by Al Williamson largely, which was just the most mind-blowing artwork I'd seen when I was a kid, because it had all of Kirby's dynamism and weight, but all of Williamson's finesse and subtlety to it. So that was a real favourite. Also, just kind of freewheeling as things pop into my mind, there was a British newspaper strip called Jeff Hawke.
Oh, yeah,
which was in the Daily Express, which was a kind of right-leaning newspaper. And my mum was a very left-leaning woman, but she still used to get the Daily Express every day just because I loved Jeff Hawke, and I would cut it out and stick it in my exercise books. And that had a magical quality to it. It was drawn by an artist called Sidney Jordan, but written by a guy called Willie Patterson, who came up with the most incredible mixtures of adventure and science fiction and humour and a real eerie feeling and a real sense of the bizarreness of existence. And he also wrote things in other comics. I mean, I didn't discover this till years later. He used to write a thing called Wrath of the Gods, which the wonderful British artist Ron Embleton drew, which was in Boy's World. And again, these stories based on Greek myth had a real magical feeling to them. In American comics, as I say, there was the Jack Kirby, Al Williamson Race for the Moon. But there was another short-lived series called The Man in Black, called Fate. Man in Black called Fate, which was drawn by Bob Powell, who was a real journeyman American artist, but a wonderful draftsman. And again, those stories had this kind of worlds beyond, you know, the weird workings of fate kind of feeling to them. I always like those kind of stories when I come to think about it. So they gave me particular pleasure. And of course, I'm lucky enough to have most of this stuff in reprint now, so I'm still able to enjoy it. But yeah, I mean, it's weird because although you haven't asked me directly about Watchmen, you know, when Alan and I were doing Watchmen, a lot of the long conversations we would have were just about such things as what were your favourite comics and what was that flavour that these things used to have that you found so Moorish as a kid that was so magical to you and actually made you want to tell stories or made you want to explore the weirdness a bit. So, I mean, probably if I wasn't doing this ad lib, I could think of many more examples, but they're quite often the things that are just off the mainstream that are the most fascinating, you know? And of course, things that used to mystify me as a kid, like with Jack Kirby, because Jack, you couldn't mistake Kirby's artwork, but sometimes he'd be inked by Al Williamson, in which case it looked very artistic and textural and, you know, quality. Other times it would be inked by Dick Ayers, who was a very prolific inker, but he had a kind of squidgy, sort of slightly flabbier kind of line.
Yeah.
And then sometimes he'd be inked by Wally Wood, who had that really sharp, hard-edged style. And I thought that he maybe was, depending on what sort of mood the artist was in, how well he drew or something like that.
Yeah.
And it took me years to fathom out that, you have a separate inker.
Yeah.
So again, even within these flavours of things you like, there are odd little tweaks to the recipe that fascinate you because they just slightly change the experience. So
I think that's very interesting. Somebody you and I have talked about quite a bit in the past is Ditko. I'm a huge Ditko fan, and my belief most of the time is that Ditko's one of those guys that he confounded most inkers, and most people inking Ditko's work, which aren't a great many because he did a lot of his own stuff, but most it's not very successful. I think personally one of the exceptions to that is somebody you just name checked, a person with a style you wouldn't think would mesh with Ditko, but when you see it, I think it delivers beautiful results, and that's Wally Wood. I think Wally Wood on Ditko weirdly works, even though he's almost the antithesis of what Ditko does. But
Well, you see, I think it comes back to the whole thing about inkers. You know, there's that slur about inkers are just tracers.
Tracer.
There's that whole riff about that.
Yeah.
Well, the thing about it is, I'm going to go a bit intellectual now. I'm sure you can handle it, Andrew.
Yeah.
But there are two schools of thought, which is either that comic art is that's pencil and inked is either the inking is just making the pencil work clean and legible. So in other words, is essentially a kind of tracing, which is very faithful to the pencils and doesn't add much personality. Or you can view it as the pencils are merely the scaffolding, they're the sketch, and the actual drawing are the inks. Now, the way I tend to draw is I've nearly always inked my own stuff, and I've always been slightly dissatisfied when my stuff has been inked by other people. Even wonderfully talented inkers, I find it difficult to finish the work to the degree that... Now, I'm not putting that quite right. I never finish the pencils to the degree that you could just trace them. There's always drawing work left to be done because as I mainly ink my own stuff, I would get bored if I just drew the line in pencil and then drew it again in ink. And looking at what pencils I've seen of Ditko's, he didn't do a lot of drawing in the pencils. He'd get the proportions right and the general attitude, but a lot of what makes a Ditko drawing is done with a brush in the process of inking it. So probably the fact that his work looks a bit uninspiring when inked by other people is because they miss the Ditko. The Ditko is the ink. It's got nothing to do with the pencils. Even with as powerful an artist as Kirby, you know, his work can be weakened by some inkers and strengthened by others. And so, I've never liked just penciling. Because I actually find to get it to the degree that I can be sure that the inks will please me, I have to actually do as much drawing as if I just drew it in ink anyway.
Yeah.
So it's a strange thing. I'd much rather do the complete job. or I would like to ink other people. It's quite relaxing to ink other people because, well, for a start, if it turns out crap, well, it wasn't my fault. You know, yeah. I just finished it off. But if you're working with a good penciler, you can learn so much. I mean, I did a couple of books with Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, yeah. who is my favorite draftsman in America.
Just amazing.
And it was an education to ink his stuff. And what he gave me was not the final line, but such a well-drawn line that it's just like, I can relax, I can ink, I can flourish, I can bring my personality to this because really all the hard work has been done. So, yeah, so there's a whole thesis there as to the kind of the intellectual process of penciling for others or inking other people's work. That's my 10 cents.
I think that it makes total sense. It's fascinating. Dave, the books that you inked for Jose Luis Garcia Lopez, what were mm-hmm. they?
It was a series called Legacies, which was published by DC. And,
right.
and it was a history of the DC. It was the over history of the DC universe. And he did this, and I inked the Silver Age, which was brilliant because I got to ink his version of some of my favorite images in DC Comics, you know, like the two Flashes with the wall in between
them,
and they're both running down the side of the wall, or Starro the Conqueror with all the JLA coming in, or recreations of some of the JLA covers, like where they're all pins in a bowling alley and the Atom is in a little ball. And when we divvy the artwork up, it's done completely impartially. I think they just go one for you, one for you, one for you, one for you. I ended up with a lot of those best pages. So it was a wonderful experience, and I also ended up with some great original artwork by one of my favourite artists of my favourite moments in DC Comics history. So that was good, and it was weird because sometimes you do so much drawing, you can remember what you were listening to while you were drawing it, and because it was inking, when you're inking, the verbal part of your mind isn't really used at all. When you're writing, you can't listen to anything very much, not even singing, because it's got words in it. But when you're inking, you can listen to dramas, plays, anything you like. And what sustained me through inking all that was The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I listened to the whole trilogy. While I drew these however many pages of comics it was, I listened to the whole way through. So there's this weird juxtaposition of looking at the artwork and remembering what I was listening to on the day that I inked that image. So, yeah.
That is fascinating. And Jose Luis Garcia Lopez was famously, he was DC's style guide guy for a long time, right?
Yeah.
So if you ever see, particularly up until about 10, 15 years ago, any licensed images of Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, The Flash, et al., it's always his draftsmanship, right?
It is. And actually, I was up at DC one day, it must have been in the 80s, and I actually picked up that style guide. I know they're quite sought after now, but they are the definitive DC characters. That's how they look, which I think is why they called on him to do this Silver Age episode, because he's bang on model anyway, and he does draw the best version of all the DC characters. There is absolutely no doubt about it. And I did get to work with him another time. I wrote a thing called Cal, which was an Elseworlds story about Superman coming to Earth in medieval times in England.
Yes.
And
I've read that book, mate. I own it, in fact.
Good. And he drew that. And Mike Carlin, the editor, was kind enough to send me art size Xeroxes of everything
that
he drew. And his even when he's just doing his first layout of the pages, his draftsmanship is so on the money and so expressive and so well proportioned. And he does the thing that all the best artists can do, which is to make, you know, it's okay to draw action scenes and battles and aliens and things exploding, but to draw people just walking down the street or just sitting down talking, he can make that stuff exciting as well. And that's the real mark of an artist, that he can transform the mundane into the special.
Yeah. Who else have you collaborated with? Who was the artist on Ran Thanagar?
Oh, that was Ivan Rice. I mean, some of the draftsmen in comics nowadays are just amazing. Ivan Rice has got such a grasp of action and anatomy and such an appetite for complexity and detail and everything like that. And it was a really complicated story, that, in that there was a whole big cast of characters and there were two planets at war with battle fleets and soldiers. And it was one of the first things that I wrote in my second go round at DC. And he really made me look so good because, you know, he took the almost impossible things I was asking him to draw, which I suppose made me appreciate, as I was saying earlier, writers have said to me that, oh, that when I realised you could draw anything I wanted, that felt great. And certainly he went above and beyond to draw what I'd asked for. And I also worked with Steve Rude on...
Well, you are beating me to my questions, mate, because so I'm not saying this just because we're chatting, but that is my all-time favourite iteration of World's Finest. Okay. I think, and you know, I've read a lot of comics, and I love the way you portray the relationship. You and Steve put it together, and I particularly love the, I think you got Clark and Bruce exactly right in that book.
All right.
Okay. And anybody listening to this, they absolutely needs to check this out. It's collected in some lovely editions, World's Finest by Dave Gibbons and Steve Rude. But what were your thoughts going into that project?
Well, I mean, I got the job because Mike Carlin had seen a thing that I'd done for a sort of small press magazine in England called A1.
Yeah.
And I'd written this story called Survivor, and it obviously was Superman. It didn't anywhere in it say that it was Superman, because it was all seen through his eyes. So you never saw yourself apart from your hands stretched out in front of you as you flew. And I was originally going to write and draw it, but in the end, I didn't have time, and an artist called Ted McKeever, who's a wonderful artist, but diametrically opposite to the way who's a good friend of mine. I mean, I've known him for many, many years. He drew it, and it was basically what it would be like to be super, that it would be a bit of a prison, really, because you'd never grow old. It's a bit like being immortal. You'd never grow old or die, but everybody around you would. And you could read every book in the world in an evening, and you didn't particularly feel anything. Nothing could harm you. Nothing could particularly please you. And it was about the ennui. And it sounds so dark of being the world's mightiest man. And basically the story is he engineers a way for his arch enemy to apparently kill him and kill himself. So that ties the whole thing off. And Mike Carlin had seen that, and he rather liked the kind of voice that it was done in, although it was completely opposite from World's Finest. But he thought I could do something with Superman anyway. So he phoned me up and said, oh, you know, we understand you're looking to write things. Would you be interested in doing World's Finest? And despite the fact that for your initial story to be called World's Finest, you know, it's like, you know, this is the best thing ever written. It's the first thing I've ever done. Seemed a bit strange, but I always loved it as a kid, because when I was a kid, the only team up you would get would be Superman and Batman. And they appeared in World's Finest comics. And I said, yeah, I'd love to do that. Who's the artist? And he said, Steve Rude. And I said, absolutely, because Steve is a brilliant, brilliant draftsman and really gets into projects. He really lives and breathes them. Very passionate man. Like a lot of really passionate artists, he's perhaps lives in a slightly different world, but in a wonderful and amazing world. And I've had many, many enjoyable interactions with him over the years. And he took what I wrote and just absolutely made it kind of classic. He did the classic Superman, the classic Batman. He got all the nuances of their body language. And it's amazing with things like playing Clark Kent off about against Bruce Wayne. Obviously, it's in what they say, but a lot of it is in the body language and the way they physically relate to each other. And Steve did all that stuff and made it absolutely live and added touches to it that I had never imagined. And I think it does hold up quite well. It's basically playing yin against yang. You know, it's the sort of dark, mysterious yin of Batman against the bright, positive yang of Superman, and how those two things contrast and enhance each other. And then using their environments in a similar way, you know, the sort of gothic crowdedness of Gotham and the sort of bright futuristic spaciousness of Metropolis, and, you know, the Joker, who's a clown, against Luther, who's a hard-edged scientist, you know, and I just managed to weave all these things together and then take Batman and put him in Metropolis with the Joker and take Luther and put him in Gotham with Superman. Yeah. And it all just, you know, so it was an enjoyable thing to do. I wouldn't want to go back and do it again, because actually to put Superman and Batman in the same story is a little bit problematical, I think. It's hard to see them existing in exactly the same world, I think. That might just be my limitation as a writer. But I suppose, like lots of things that I've done in my career, it's been my fanboy dream come true. Like, oh, I'd love to write Superman and Batman, but not forever, but just enough to say, I've done it and express what thoughts I've got. And I think that was so with, you know, many things I've done, like the chance that we got to meet Alan Moore and I to work on The Spirit for Will Eisen. Spirit, tick, done it. You know, so and then I did Batman versus Predator, which was very well liked, but I didn't want to do another one because, you know, you've seen that fight. But yeah, but World's Finest, yeah, was a great thing to do, and I owe a lot of it to Steve Rude's talent of making people very, very real.
I think it's a beautiful book, and you just touched upon something that I think you guys pulled off and so many people didn't. And that was a new iteration of The Spirit, or a take on The Spirit, that was very respectful to Eisner. And your book, of course, was produced while he was still alive, and were very respectful to Eisner while sort of grabbing the heart of what he produced, which is what I think a lot of people miss, because I guess Eisner is essentially an O. Henry figure. You know, Spirit himself is often a cipher for a brilliant short story, which he only plays an incidental part in. And I think there's been a move with a lot of Spirit adaptations to put him at the centre of the narrative, which is not, I think, it seems to me as a big fan, is not how he's best deployed.
But No, he's quite often a walk-on in his own stories. Yeah. Certainly the three stories that Alan and I did in that first issue, that was essentially it. I mean, they were kind of his origin, or they were the events of the night that he became the Spirit, told in three different ways, because Eisner had done three different versions of it. But certainly in a couple of the stories, you only briefly see the Spirit, or he's the investigating detective who's observing the action. But that is the nature of the Spirit. But as I say, I think a lot of that is to do with, like I was saying, that there's stuff that I like that I would discuss at length with Alan, or he would discuss his favourites with me. And I think Alan in particular, if you look at a lot of the things he's written, he's really good at getting to the essence of something. And the three stories that he wrote for the Spirit, to me, were classic Spirit stories. He exactly identified the mood and the feeling and the weight of them and the degree of humour, because the Spirit was not a totally serious character. There was always a bit of humour in there. Yeah. And a lot of the supporting characters were drawn in a somewhat cartoony way. And it gave me an interesting chance to kind of do, although it is the same artwork, three slightly different takes using the sort of decorative borders or those kind of graphic effects that Eisner would use, and then doing a thing that was a slightly moodier story, and then one that was quite ridiculous and cartoony. So, yeah, it was great to have done that with a writer like Alan, who absolutely got it. And it was good to do something that I know Eisner liked, because he sent me a note to say that he did really like it. And he did, when I happened to meet up with him before we started on it, say, "I'm really interested to see what you and Alan do, but there's just one thing. Please don't make the Spirit a drug addict." I said, I mean, I don't know if he was influenced by Alan's haircut or something like that, but we were never, ever going to do something like that with the Spirit. But yeah, so, but again, as I say, the real key to my career is I'm a fanboy who always says yes to the thing that I've wanted to do since I was a kid. And certainly the Spirit would fall under that. And it was also great as well, because I've got the DC archives of the Spirit.
Yeah.
And they're all matching volumes. There's 27 of them. But then Dark Horse did the 28th book, which was the stuff from The New Adventures of the Spirit. So my work is there on the bookshelf at the end of Eisner's. So, yeah, that was a great experience.
Well, yeah, I'm a proud possessor of that set and that volume as well. And it's got to feel great. Mm. In addition, I think what it's always great to talk to you about comics, Dave, is in addition to being, you know, a much respected, you know, artist and creator and being a fanboy yourself, you always strike me as very articulate comics evangelist, which not all creators are. You know, I mean, I think you're always, you know, you're always very studied in your analysis of, you know, your peers and the people who influence you, and it's just such a lot of fun to get into that and listen to what you've got to say.
Oh, good. Well, yeah, I mean, it's such a large part of my life. I think it's really possible. And, you know, isn't the Liverpudlian expression a gobshite? I mean,
correct.
I can talk.
Gobshite, mate.
and so, I mean, I do love to talk about and discuss things with people. And as I say, I spent many happy hours just talking about comics, nothing to do with the work that Alan and I were doing. And you know, there are things about comics which work on an obvious level, but there's lots of stuff that is on a subtle level, and a lot of things. I think just I've always been fascinated as well by the mental processes of creating comics and seeing how people work and seeing what their process is, and realizing that although we draw in different ways, we all have the same pressures, we all have the same misgivings. Most of the really good artists and creative people I know have great self-doubt, are all beset by imposter syndrome, you know, and so I find it really interesting to explore that kind of inner world of doing comics as well. And you mentioned the Tomorrow's books and magazines earlier. I really love the looks that they've given, and that unfortunately they came along while still quite a lot of the Golden Age creators and certainly the Silver Age creators were alive and did really good in-depth interviews with them. And yeah, I learned a lot from that about the artists that I'd admired. And I'm always really happy to talk about comics to people. And I quite often find all those who very kindly say I forget what the complimentary term was. You can learn so much by talking to other people, not just you imparting your wisdom, but their fresh take on comics and their views of what makes comics exciting.
And for sure, I mean, that's a great thing about these conversations. You know, comic books is a living, breathing art form, and perspective is always fascinating, right? Whoever mm-hmm. that perspective, you know, because it requires you to invest to enjoy it. Comics are things you have to absorb. You know, funnily enough, the very reputation they had when people were growing up in the 50s that they were disposable, actually, I believe it takes quite a lot of investment to really savor a comic book, because it's existing in a number of different dimensions, right? You're reading the words, you're reading the art. It's a glorious symbiosis of both of those things. Mm. And so a lot of comics fans, like comics creators, who are comics fans, of course, have just fascinating opinions.
Yeah, and I mean, there is also the thing, I mean, what's that famous question? When was the golden age of science fiction? And the answer is 12.
Yeah,
you know, that many of us come across these things when our brains and our thought processes and our tastes are still being formed.
Yeah,
and again, isn't there is it Noel Coward or something who said about the power of cheap music? You know, this even quite badly done things can have a tremendous emotional power.
Yeah,
music, images, movies, comics. And I think they get to you at a stage like the Jesuits, you know, if they've got you at 9 years old, they've probably got you forever. So, yeah, it's and of course, I mean, I think it's always been a thing that slightly offended me, probably more than it should have, that comics are sort of looked upon as low culture.
Yeah.
And are kind of, you know, disregarded or felt to be marginal. I mean, in fact, for a lot of people, it is their first exposure to hand-drawn images and story and, you know, adventure and interest and magic and all the things that you get from a literary experience and an artistic experience at the same time. So I think I've always been a great proponent for discussing them in the depth that any other art form would warrant. And I think there is plenty to be said. And I think there are some very original talents. I mean, the other thing about doing comics is that it's the relentless amount of creativity. I used to know a guy who was a visualizer in an advertising agency. And I showed him, he came around my house and he looked at a page of comic art. I'd done, said, so how long did this take you to do, David? What, about a month's work, is it? I said, no, that was a day. He said, a day? You drew that in a day? He said, God, it would take me a month to draw anything near that. I mean, he was a really good artist and really good at being a visualizer. But even being that, he didn't spend anything like the amount of concentrated time that a comic book artist spends. And also, just because of the amount of time you spend and the intensity, it actually accesses your subconscious because you're having to pull this stuff up from somewhere. And we talked about Kirby and Ditko, and a lot of their stuff is unfiltered from their subconscious. And so it's got a tremendous interest and charm just because it's somebody with their pants down almost, you know? Yeah. So there's that whole aspect of it as well. And I mean, I wouldn't want comics to be completely respectable because I think there's something about their subversiveness, which is part of the charm. But I'm really pleased to see that they are and indeed have for some time approached the level of regard that most of the other popular art forms seem to have, like movies, like music, like dance, you know. And I think the French call it the ninth art. Actually don't know what the other eight arts are, but even if we're ninth, I'm very happy that comics are seen in that way nowadays.
Yeah, well said, mate. That is a hard degree from me. And the thing about the ninth art is I have not heard that expression before, and I don't know what 1 to 8 are either, but the ninth art sounds very cool.
It does. It does. It almost sounds like a Mobius book, doesn't it? The ninth art.
Absolutely.
The sixth incal or something like that. Yeah. So it's good. And of course, in my later years, it's possible for me to have these discussions, which is great. I mean, when I wanted to draw comics, I thought it would just be you'd sit in a room and draw pictures. But the fact that you get to travel the world, you get to meet interesting people from all over the place, that your work is seen all over the world, that you're able to have discussions like this with other people who are passionate and informed about comics, and that it's available to anybody who can be bothered to log on, is a wonderful thing. So I don't draw so many comics nowadays, but I'm always very, very happy to talk about them.
Yeah, and I'm very happy that you chose to join me today. And thanks very much for your time, mate. I've really enjoyed it. You'll be pleased to hear that I think I asked maybe 3 of the questions I had in my mind and none of the others, which is, I knew that's the way I knew it would go. But if you can find the time in the future, I would love to have you back on to get into the other stuff I wanted to talk to you about.
I'm sure I've got at least another episode's worth of stuff to unveil.
Fantastic. No,
always a pleasure to talk to you, Andrew. And we are, with the prevailing circumstances, as I think we said before, a bit overdue for one of your nice lunches.
Right on.
But let's talk like this again and hopefully talk in person with a drink in hand before too long.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, when I've been jabbed as well as you and when things open up, we're doing that for sure. And I'll look forward to seeing you again soon, mate.
Yeah. All right, Andrew. That's excellent. Thanks very much for the interesting questions.
Thanks so much. Take care, mate. Yeah, I'll see you soon.
Cheers. Bye. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Dave. I'll wrap us out there. Thank you. That was brilliant. That was just the job. Yeah. Yeah. Great to see you, mate. And thanks very much for making the time for me. I do appreciate it.
Yeah. I mean, I hope I didn't ramble on too long because I can ramble on and on and on and on. But
I was hoping that I knew you could fill an hour quite easily. I was hoping that you would. And I know with you, I'm in safe hands in terms of I can queue up the questions, we'll go somewhere interesting, and we'll keep on going somewhere interesting.
You could piss off and watch the football, it wouldn't make a difference.
That's right, yeah, exactly. No, the way Liverpool are doing at the moment, you know, it might start me, it might lead to a few tears.
Yeah, so where's this going to appear, Andrew?
Okay, so basically, there's a bunch of guys who run a kind of a podcast hub in Seattle. It's called Spoilerverse. And they do a bunch of things. The main one is called Spoiler Country. And I've been a guest talking about comics and movies on that for about 2 or 3 years. That I pop in every couple of episodes, and every time I'm in town for work, I record 3 or 4 and they run them throughout the year. And they were like, do you want to do your own podcast where you just get to interview the people you know and talk about the things you're interested in and passionate about? I was like, yeah, shit, I'll do that. And then I thought, well, since I'm recording all this stuff for Forbidden Planet these days, you know, it's very easy for now I've got the setup. It's very easy for, and I'm not recording video. I'll just, you know, the people I really like chatting to, whenever they're free, I'll record one. So it's called Hardegree, and the podcast launches at the end of this month. So when it goes out there, I'll send you the link so you can put it on your social media and whatnot.
It also explains why your emails were titled Hardegree. I thought you were saying, Dave, you've got to agree to this. and I also admire the way you did slip it into the interview.
Yeah.
But I would like to see the podcast called Hard Disagree. That's what I would like to see. It would be a fist fight, you know.
Oh, yeah, that would be awesome. The thing is, I might run this bit of extra footage, by the way, because this is good stuff. The thing is, I'm essentially a positivist, you know. I'm a lover, not a fighter, you know. But I do like that concept of fisticuffs at dawn, particularly over who your favourite artist is.
All right, Angela, so I think we should.
Right on.
But it has been great. I'm pleased to see you looking well. Keep well, get the jab, and we'll have a pint in the sunshine.
I'm looking forward to it, mate. Yeah. You take care of yourself, and I'll see
you soon.
All the
best, Andrew.
Thanks, Dave. That was great. Thanks, mate.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Hardegree. This episode was edited by John Horsley and Kenrick Regan, and our theme music, Golden, was written and performed for this show by Liverpool's finest band, Denio. Hardegree is a production of The Spoilerverse and myself, Andrew Sumner.